Om Namah Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namah Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namah Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 2, Divinity and Divine Service, text number 15. Word meanings: yet, which, anujjha, remembrance, basina, sword, yukta, being equipped with, karma, reactionary work, granti, knot, nibandhanam, internet, Kindanti, cut, kovidaha, intelligent, tasya, his, kaha, who, na, not, kuryat, shall do, kata, messages, ritim, attention. Yadanu dyasina yukta, karmaganti nibandhanam, Chindanti Govidastasya Kona Kuryat Katarutim Yadanudhyasina Yukta Karmagranti Nibandhanam Chindanti Govidastasya Kona kuryat katarutim Yadanudhyasina yukta Karma granti nibandhanam Chindanti kovidastasya Kona kuryat katarutim Yadanudhyasina yukta
Karmagranti nibandhanam
Karmagranti nibandhanam
Chindanti kovidastasya
Chindanti kovidastasya
Kona kuryat katarutim
Kona kuryat katarutim Translation. With sword in hand, intelligent man cut through the binding knots of reactionary work, karma, by remembering the personality of Godhead. Therefore, who will not pay attention to his message? Srila Prabhupada's purport. The contact of the spiritual spark with material elements creates a knot which must be cut if one wants to be liberated from the actions and reactions of fruitive work. Liberation means freedom from the cycle of reactionary work. This liberation automatically follows for one who constantly remembers the transcendental pastimes of the personality of Godhead. This is because all the activities of the Supreme Lord, his Leela, are transcendental to the modes of material energy. They are all attractive spiritual activities, and therefore constant association with the spiritual activities of the Supreme Lord gradually spiritualizes the conditioned soul and ultimately severs the knot of material bondage. Liberation from material bondage is therefore a byproduct of devotional service. Attainment of spiritual knowledge is not sufficient to ensure liberation. Such knowledge must be overcoated with devotional service, so that ultimately the devotional service alone predominates. Then liberation is made possible. Even the reactionary work of the fruitive workers can lead one to liberation when it is overcoated with devotional service. Karma overcoated with devotional service is called karma yoga. Similarly, empirical knowledge overcoated with devotional service is called jnana yoga. But pure bhakti yoga is independent of such karma and jnana, because it alone can not only endow one with liberation from conditional life, but also award one the transcendental loving service of the Lord. Therefore, any sensible man who is above the average man with a poor fund of knowledge must constantly remember the personality of Godhead by hearing about him, by glorifying him, by remembering him, and by worshiping him always without cessation. That is the perfect way of devotional service. The Goswamis of Vrindavan, who were authorized by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to preach the bhakti cult, rigidly followed this rule and made immense literatures of transcendental science for our benefit. They have chalked ways out for all classes of men in terms of the different castes and orders of life in pursuance of the teachings of Srimad Bhagavatam and similar other authoritative scriptures. With sword in hand, intelligent men cut through the binding knots of reactionary work, karma, by remembering the personality of Godhead. Therefore, who will not pay attention to his message? We've been hearing about bhakti, how bhakti is the ultimate good for everyone in human society, and then different verses elaborating on that theme. How bhakti is meant for serving the absolute truth, what that absolute truth is. In yesterday's verse, therefore, we should, with one-pointed attention, one should constantly hear about, glorify, remember, and worship the personality of Godhead, who is the protector of the devotee. So this is devotional service in a nutshell. We know from Prahlad Maharaj, we have 9 kinds of devotional service. So 4 of them were mentioned in yesterday's verse. Kirtanam, Vishnu, Smaranam, and then, what would we say, Archanam. These 4 things were mentioned. So then today it says, it refers to one of these, you can say, because one of the 4 is to remember or to meditate upon. Dhyana, Smaranam, Dhyana. Actually, technically, Smaranam is one of the categories of dhyana. Dhyana is meditation, and deep meditation. There's, of course, deep smadhana, where Krishna's lila actually becomes manifest within one's heart. But even in the practicing stage of Krishna consciousness, we have to remember the Lord. Hearing, chanting, and remembering. Or here it's dhyana. We hear the word here is anudhya. So you can hear, of course, the root of dhyana there. Dhyana, meditation, dhyana. So anudhya, remembrance or meditation, fixing the mind, anu. Prabhupada would often quote on this prefix, or often speak on this prefix, anu. Anu means to follow. So in many places, where, for example, if it says anushravana, so to hear, but the anu part, what does it mean? It means to hear following. And he would say, that means parampara. What is the parampara? Actually, the word literally means something like one after the other, being passed down, parampara. You can kind of hear it in the other, para, para, para. One meaning of para is other. So parampara, passed down from one to the other. So following, each one is following the other, the previous acharya, and all of those before. So anadhyā, there's also an implication here that The remembrance has to be following the parampara. It has to be bona fide remembrance. It can't be concocted. So then we have this metaphor. This anugya is asina, means it's a sword. And what is that? Yukta means equipped with. Yukta is related to the word yoga. Yuktasya bhaktans janiyan jatopi. We have in our Guru Vashtaka prayers. The spiritual master engages us in service to the deity, and he also serves the deity. So here it's equipped with. Yuktaha. So equipped with, or engaged with, the sword of remembrance, what happens? Karma granti nibandhanam chindanti. Prabhupada translates karma here as reactionary work. In other words, work that has reactions. And what's the nature of that karma? It's a knot. Internet nibandhanam. Bandha, of course, the word bandha. Bandha means knot or being bound up. So it's a knot, it's a very, very tight knot. There's another verse, is it, where it talks about the labyrinthine knot. Oh, here's another. I just flipped ahead. Verse 21. Thus the knot in the heart is pierced, and all misgivings are cut to pieces. The chain of fruitive actions is terminated when one sees the self as master. So it's a knot that keeps us bound up in this material world, and it's a very difficult knot to untie. Prabhupada gave that example. So just like you want to tie a knot really tight, then you tie one, and then you tie another, and then you tie another, and another, and another. So you can't, and you get to a point where there's so many knots, you can't get it out. Just like somebody has matted hair, try to get all the knots out of that hair. Impossible. What do you just shave up? That's all you can do at that point. Just cut it. Yeah, cut it with the sword, scissors. So the knot of karma, it's endless. Can't figure it out. Even how karma works is an endless task in trying to figure it out. It's so complicated. I always have so many questions about karma. You can't figure it out intellectually. Actually, our karma goes back so far. There are indications of this. For example, in the story of Ajamil, it says there that by chanting Hare Krishna, the Lord's name, one time, one is freed from the sinful reactions of millions of lifetimes. So that means we have karma going back millions of lifetimes. That's what that implies. It's not just, you know, one in the next life you get rid of all the one you had in the previous life. Somehow, those karmas hang around for a long, long time. So to try to get rid of them, you can't do it piece by piece. You know, in the beginning of the sixth canto of the Bhagavatam, Shukadeva Goswami has just heard from, Pariksit Maharaj has just heard from Shukadeva Goswami, the fifth canto. The fifth canto, we hear a lot about the universe, and we hear about all the different places we may go in this universe. And at the very end, we hear in the last chapter of the fifth canto, we hear about the hellish planet. So when Pariksit Maharaj hears about the hellish planets, he wants to know how can we save people from that, or how can people be saved from that? It's so horrible. I know when I read the Bhagavatam, I just want to skip that chapter. It's so hard to hear it. It's so heavy what goes on in those hellish planets, how people are being punished. So Pariksit Maharaj, naturally, he's a compassionate devotee. He wants to know, well, what can we do? Make sure people don't go there. How to free ourselves and free others from that destiny. So Shukadeva Goswami, he begins his reply by talking about the path of karma, actually. He says, well, people have to do prayaschitta. You have to balance it out. You have to, you know, for every bad thing, then you have to do a good thing. So they cancel each other out. When Pariksit Maharaj hears that, he doesn't accept it. Basically, he says, I don't think that's right. That's not true. He said, that's like the bathing of an elephant. Everyone is familiar with this idea. So that's the context of it in the Bhagavatam. That's where Pariksit Maharaj says that. You can never get free of karma in that way. Because you haven't uprooted, people haven't uprooted the desire for more sinful activities, so they'll just go on sinning again and again, and the same thing will happen. And of course, that's implied also in this idea of the knot, is that it's endless. It just goes on and on and on. You can't get free of it. You can't untie yourself. Especially you have a knot behind your back and your hands are tied. What can you do? In the old movies, they could free themselves, but actually, it's extremely difficult to try to free yourself when your hands are tied behind your back. So that's what karma is. You can't free yourself from it. You can't free it yourself from it by prayaschitta. We don't really know much about prayaschitta. I think it's in the fifth canto where Prabhupada says there are 20 different kinds of dharma shastras. And a lot of those have to do with this kind of thing. If you did this thing, then to get free of the reaction, do this good act. You'll find that kind of thing in other Puranas, like Garuda Purana, for example. So some people actually try to figure these things out. Oh, I have to do this because that will free me from, you know, this reaction, you know, do my penance. So there are people who think that karma is actually a good thing. The idea of liberation doesn't come into their minds. They think that this is just the nature of reality. They know about the heavenly planets. They know about doing good works, and they know about the hellish planets. So they think, well, I don't want to go to hell. I'll just do all the things that get me to heaven. So that's as far as they go. They don't somehow, even traditionally in Vedic culture, there are many people, either they don't want to hear from the sadhus who will tell them something more, or they ignore it. They like the idea of going to heaven. They're attracted by that. So they don't want liberation. They don't bother me with that. I just want to go to heaven. I want to go to Swarga Loka. Oh, that's so nice. So that's what they aim for, going to Swarga Loka to enjoy there. But Pariksit Maharaj, he says, yeah, what happens? You go to heaven, but you also go to hell. You stay on that karma path. You get the good and the bad. I like to quote this in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. There's this line in one verse. Kabu swarage utai, kabu narake dubai. It means sometimes you go up to swarga, sometimes you go down to hell. And that's another analogy that everyone is familiar with, the dunking stool. Sometimes you're dunked into the water as a punishment, and when you're about ready to die, then you come up, you get some breath of fresh air. So that's the context of that. That's what that's about. Sometimes you get some pleasure in heaven, but then you get dunked again. Either Marchaloka in this world, well, the whole material world is Marchaloka, but on earth planets, or you go down to hell. Because it's very difficult. Like we know in the story of King Nriga, poor King Nriga, when you hear his story, you think, what did he do wrong? It wasn't even his fault. But karma is such a demanding path that even if by accident you do the wrong thing, you still have to suffer for it. Just like actually that happens too in our world. I think sometimes, for example, you can go to jail for a long time just if you have an accident and somebody dies. Or someone's walking along the street and maybe, you know, they step out into the road, it's nighttime, and you hit them and kill them. And you can go to jail for a long time and it wasn't even your fault. Somehow they decide it was your fault and you end up in jail. So it's there's danger at every step. I sometimes look back at my life and I think, boy, how did I make it? How did I survive not going to jail or this, something, some horrible thing happening to me? And Krishna protected me, I guess. That's the answer. But karma, the path of karma is like that. So you have to just cut it. You have to cut the knot. So that's what's being described here. How do you cut it? By remembrance. That's an amazing thing. This knot that's so powerful. The knots have been added for millions of lifetimes, and all you have to do is remember Krishna. That cuts it. There's a story in I don't know the whole story, but the idea of the Gordian knot. And somebody, is it Alexander or somebody, comes with his sword, and nobody could untie the knot, and he came with his sword and just cut it. I don't know the whole context of the story. But that's, you know, the idea with, you know, we're trying to untie the knot. In a sense, every karmi, even vikarmi, if they're not following the Vedic literature, they're trying to untie the knot in the sense that they want good things to happen to them. And they're trying to untie it by, you know, living a good life and going to school and getting an education and getting a good job and having a nice family. That's how they're trying to untie the knot, you might say, because they're trying to get happiness in karma by, you know, the bad things that are going to happen, try to stop those from happening by having good things happen to me. So anyway, so the point here is that by remembering the personality of Godhead, you cut that knot. So then the next line is, therefore, who will not pay attention to his message? So this is a nice point because it says, you cut the knot by remembering, but how do you remember? You remember by hearing. So these two are connected. And of course, how do you hear? By chanting. By chanting yourself or somebody else chanting. Someone chants or you chant, or even mentally chant by reading or hearing. You're hearing it in that way. There's some sound coming, even in a sense, the Bhagavatam is speaking to us. So we're hearing it. It's chanting. We're hearing all the sages, all the acharyas, the pure devotees, Mahabhagavats, who are speaking to us through the Srimad Bhagavatam. They're speaking, they're chanting, they're kirtanam, and we're shravanam, we're hearing, and the result is smaranam, or anudhyasana, anudhya. We're remembering the Lord by that. So that will cut through the knot of reactionary work. The Prabhupada begins his purport by talking about what is the source of that. What does he say here? The contact of the spiritual spark with material elements creates a knot which must be cut if one wants to be liberated from the actions and reactions of fruitive work. So first there, you have to have that desire. I want to get out. These things are happening to me that I don't like. If you know, we often pose this question, human life means, you know, first asking, why am I suffering? Really, the first, of course, with Sanat Goswami, it was, who am I and why am I suffering? Kayami kenayamaya jaritapatraya. Why do the threefold misery, why are they coming to me? I don't want them to come. I want only good things to come. Why do bad things come? So that, then if you, somebody tells you, it's karma. Of course, today people know a little something about karma. But more and more, it's just part of popular culture. People just use the word karma. But they also don't know the idea of liberation. Maybe they do. They may have, because yoga is more popular today. A lot of times yoga, of course, we have the physical side. Usually people talk about it in two different ways, yoga and meditation. Some people do yoga, only the exercise part. They don't know about the meditation part. But there are also people who have yogis. I have a sister-in-law who's into yoga. She just talks about her yogi. So they have yogis. So these yogis, oftentimes, of course, they also give them some philosophy. But what is it going to be? It's going to be impersonal. You know, it's going to be about liberation. But at least some people maybe have this idea, oh, I'm not this body, and there's such thing as liberation. I can become one with the Absolute. I can merge it, whatever, however they present it. So here Prabhupada gives a definition of liberation, this very basic definition of liberation. Liberation means freedom from the cycle of reactionary work. Again, this term, it's so nice, that especially in the early first canto of the Bhagavatam, Prabhupada a lot of times he just doesn't use very much Sanskrit, because he's thinking, I'm doing this for a Western audience. So instead of saying karma, which he says reactionary work. Oh, reactionary work, a work that has reactions. Of course, Prabhupada also uses the term fruitive work, which is Prabhupada's coinage, I think, because there's no such a word as fruitive in the dictionary, as I know. So, but we can figure it out. Sometimes things are just obvious. Although somebody wrote to me at BTG one time and says, what does fruitive mean? I always think, well, we use Sanskrit words that people don't understand, but sometimes we use English words that people don't understand either. So anyway, fruitive work or reactionary work. When you want the fruit, then you get a reaction. So that's what liberation means. So then in the next paragraph, Prabhupada, again, he says, liberation from material bondage is therefore a byproduct of devotional service. So this is really the important point here. In this second paragraph, Prabhupada talks about other paths. So some people are trying to get liberation. They're karmis. You know, we have this hierarchy that we describe. You have the karmis, then the jnanis and the yogis, or yogis and jnanis, whichever order you want to put them, and then, of course, the bhaktas. The bhaktas are at the top. So above the karmis are the jnanis. Actually, in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, now that I'm thinking, was it Ek Shishta? There's this verse, I forget how it goes, but it's like, among all the karmis, the best is the one who is a jnani, becomes a jnani. And among all the jnanis, I think that's the way it works, the progression. Then the yogis, right? It goes like that. Karmis, jnanis, yogis. Because you can understand the logic of it. Of course, to think about liberation, that's obviously a step above karmis. And then the jnanis, they start thinking. That's the idea. They start thinking about, you know, philosophical speculation. They start philosophizing. And then if they get it, then they realize, oh, well, if I want to really get out of this world, if I want liberation, the jnanis come to the point of understanding liberation, then I have to do something about it. And then that's yoga. You know, they're, of course, very different paths of yoga, different varieties of yoga. I was just reading the other day in Jiva Goswami's Bhakti Sandarbha, where he included Vedic sacrifices among yoga, because the yogis, they do different things. Of course, even the yogis, they sometimes worship Krishna because they think, well, that will help in some way. So they sometimes mix in. They don't necessarily just sit in one place and try to meditate. Even Dhruva Maharaj, he was practicing yoga. But when you read the instructions that Narada Muni gave him, he had him doing lots of different things, bathing three times a day, and then I think deity worship, right? And chanting Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. And of course, then we tend to think about the physical austerities that he performed. He was standing on one leg, and then, you know, he's eating, and kept less and less and less what he was eating dry leaves. But he was doing it, somehow all these things, or at least in the beginning, because I always think, well, how could he be doing, you know, the standing on the one leg and then bathing three times a day? Maybe he kind of gave that, he must have given that up after a while. He became so absorbed at some point in his meditation. Of course, that's the idea with meditation anyway, is that you increase gradually. You know, I would have the picture in my mind that someone gives up everything, they take sannyas, and then they go into the Himalayas, and then they just sit down and they just start meditating and they never stop, you know, for hundreds of years or whatever. But it doesn't work that way. You have to practice, like anything else. The first day, maybe you'll do it for 15 minutes. And you get bored and you go out looking for something to eat or whatever. So you have to practice. And of course, generally you have a guru also that helps guide you. So it happens, but Dhruva Maharaj, it sped up for him. He did the whole course very quickly. He was a child prodigy. He just went through it. But we see that in yoga there are different, you know, people can add different things to it. So the point, Prabhupada makes the point here that of course people, why do they do jnana and yoga? Because they want to get liberation. But our acharyas point out, and Prabhupada is pointing out here, you can't actually get liberation that way. You may think you're liberated, which is an interesting point actually, because we tend to think that, no, the impersonalists, all they get is Brahman. They only go to Brahman. They don't go beyond that. Or the yogis may get Paramatma realization. But it's actually explained, and I've come across it quite often, especially reading the books of the Goswamis, that you don't get liberation without bhakti. Neither the jnani nor the yogi is going to be successful unless there's some, what's the word to use here, overcoated. You can get liberation. What is he, first he mentions, well, first he mentions jnana. He says, such knowledge must be overcoated with devotional service so that ultimately the devotional service alone predominates. then liberation is made possible. So this is interesting the way Prabhupada presents it here. But it's also described that there's also, you know, jnana misra bhakti, where, or bhakti misra jnana, it's also stated that way, where you're primarily a jnani, but you have some bhakti. And that bhakti is actually what gives you the liberation. Because you can say, an easy way to look at it is, because liberation has to be rewarded by Krishna. So you please him with a little bhakti. Although when I hear this, I think, well, what kind of bhakti is it really? Because especially the impersonalists, they think impersonal. They're worshiping generally, they're worshiping the Lord. There's some bhakti, but it's sort of bhakti pro forma. You know this word pro forma. It's bhakti in form. But the heart of bhakti doesn't really seem to be there. But still, Krishna reciprocates with that. Another thing I was just reading recently. It was in an academic book on bhakti, a bunch of different essays by scholars, and there was a chapter on Lord Shiva's bhakti. What was his relationship with bhakti? And the author, a woman, she does an analysis of Shankaracharya's commentary on the Bhagavad Gita, and she quotes also, he wrote commentaries that are pretty established as having actually been written by him. Because a lot of times, when you look back at these old literatures, you don't actually know, because sometimes a disciple would put his guru's name on the work. We actually have that also in our tradition. Sometimes it's questionable. Did he write this, or did one of his disciples, or somebody else write it and put his name on it so he could get more sales? You know, just like you write a book and you write Stephen King as the author, you probably get a lot of sales. So this kind of thing goes on in spiritual traditions. So anyway, there's a question about what exactly Lord Shiva wrote. But in his analysis of Bhagavad Gita, he talks about worshipping Lord Vishnu. In fact, in the very beginning, Narayana Parovyakta. Prabhupada would often quote this, Shankaracharya. Now, Prabhupada would use it to say that actually he was a devotee, so because he said, this means that Narayana comes before the Avyakta. The Avyakta, we can say, is Brahman. So from Brahman comes the material world. So even before that is Narayana. So you think, wow, he's actually saying that Narayana is beyond. But he says a lot of different things. And he kind of, the thread that runs through his Bhagavad Gita commentary, Shankaracharya, is impersonalist. Ultimately, we are one with Brahman, and that's the goal. And even the verses that clearly seem to indicate bhakti as eternal, you know, our eternal nature is in a relationship of bhakti with the Lord. Still, he has some ways of twisting them around. Say, no, we're worshipping bhakti we're worshipping Lord Vishnu or Narayana as an aid to liberation. Ultimately, we want liberation. Now, incidentally, in this scholar's, in her essay, one of the first things she said is that in deciding what books to cite or what works of Shankaracharya to cite, I'm not going to quote any of his songs or poems, because those are highly contested of whether he wrote those or not. So of course we all love Bhajagovindam, 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 Uramate. He says, oh look, Shankaracharya is worshipping. Ultimately he's a devotee. There's another one where he says, I want to sit on the bank of the Yamuna in Vrindavan and think about Krishna, something like that. So the scholars, they say, I don't know if he wrote that or not. They don't have any way to prove it, apparently. So those who want to accept it do, and those who don't, don't. So in any case, the point is that the yogis, they sometimes mix in bhakti, but their goal is liberation. And Prabhupada is saying, yes, they won't get liberation unless they have some bhakti there. The jnanis and the yogis both. But the amazing thing about devotional service is you just do it and you get liberation automatically. We don't use bhakti as a means to the end. I mean, in some sense, of course, we do. In sadhana bhakti, it's a means to get to bhava bhakti and then prema bhakti, ultimately. But we're certainly not doing it for liberation. We don't want to become one with Krishna by practicing our bhakti. But there are people who actually think like that. There's an exchange Prabhupada had when he was in South India. There were a lot of Mayavadis there. He was in Madras in that area. Maybe he went to Tirupati maybe at that time. And there's a recording of him talking to someone, a scholarly man, but he was promoting this idea that bhakti, ultimately it's for merging into Krishna, for becoming one with Krishna. Even, of course, many scholars of Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada would talk about how many commentaries on Bhagavad Gita there are, hundreds of them. But he said, I had to write this Bhagavad Gita as it is, because most of them, they don't touch on the real point. Many of them promote this idea that Krishna is just representing the Brahman, the impersonal absolute, and he's promoting bhakti as a way to merge with him, basically, is the idea. So when someone was presenting this to Srila Prabhupada, then he quoted this line in Bhagavad Gita, Nitya Yukta Upasate. He kept saying it several times. No, Nitya Yukta Upasate. So Nitya Yukta Upasate means always engaged in his service. This is a line from Bhagavad Gita. Nitya. It's not that you give it up at a certain point. You worship Krishna, and then you get what you want. That's not real bhakti, is it? That's like a child, I'll be good. And you say, you do this, you know, for 1 week, and then you'll get ice cream on Saturday, or whatever. You get your reward. So the child doesn't really want to be good, he just wants to be mischievous, but does it for the reward. So that kind of bhakti, the reward of just becoming Krishna, entering into Krishna, Prabhupada lampooned this idea of saying, it's just like the child says to the mother, oh, mommy, I want to go back into your womb. That same level of foolishness, to want to merge into Krishna. No, the child's relationship with the mother is one of love. So that's, of course, pure bhakti. That's why we have to say pure devotional service, unmotivated devotional service, shuddha bhakti. That's what we're Ahoitukiya pratihata, causeless devotional service. This term that Prabhupada uses, causeless, is interesting. Because actually, sometimes Prabhupada uses it for this term of ahoituki. What does ahoituki means? Ahetu. What is hetu? Hetu means cause. So it can be taken in a couple of ways. One is, we often think of, if you've read it or ever read the Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's Madhurya Kadambani, he talks in the beginning about how does one get devotional service. You can't get it through karma, you can't get it through ordinary activities, and it's eternal. It's also independent, or she is independent. Of course, she acts on Krishna's orders, Bhakti Devi. So the idea is that devotional service is causeless in that sense, that you can't, you know, through your karma, janma koti sukrite na labhyate, is the other verse. How do you get it? You get it from lolyam. You get it from wanting it more than anything. Wanting Krishna bhakti rasa bhavita mati. That's a this word encapsulates the term Krishna consciousness. Krishna bhakti rasa bhavita mati. Kriyatam yadi katopi labhyate. Tata lolyam api mulamekalam. Janma koti sukrite na labhyate. So this verse says, you don't get Krishna consciousness or bhakti even by thousands or millions of lifetimes of sukriti. Now, there are different kinds of sukriti, and this verse seems to be implying that it seems to suggest that it's talking about the sukriti that's in the realm of karma. There's sukriti in the realm of jnana, which gives you liberation, mukti unmukhi sukriti, and then there's bhakti unmukhi sukriti. It's a little technical. Prabhupada talks about this in one purport in Chaitanya Charitamrita. The idea is sukriti, which just means good works. Literally, it's what it means, actually. Sukriti. So good work, there's good works in karma, there's good works in jnana, you can say, to give you liberation. And then there's good works in bhakti. So this verse says, basically, that the good works in for liberation or for karma, you won't get bhakti from that. You'll get bhakti when you really want it. And then you'll get, of course, by practicing sadhana bhakti, we hope to please the Lord and the Lord's devotees. Ultimately, it's the pure devotee of the Lord. Krishna has given them power of attorney to give out bhakti. That's how it works. If they have mercy on you, If the pure devotee has mercy on you, then you get bhakti. That's how it comes. So in that sense, it's causeless, because in one sense, we can't make it happen. Just like karma, actually it is by your own work. If you do the right things, then you'll go to heaven. That's what Krishna's talking about with Nanda Maharaj at the beginning of the Govardhan Leela. What do we need Indra? If you do A, B, C, D, you're going to go to heaven. We don't need Indra. What is he? Besides, he's himself in the realm of karma. He's a dispenser of karmic reactions. He can't dispense unless the action has been done. But Krishna is, of course, very precocious. He's very smart, so he's making this argument. So you can, in karma, if you do certain things, you fill in all the blanks, you get the reward. But it doesn't work that way in bhakti. Because it's personal. It's about Krishna. He wants love. That's what he wants. He doesn't want you just to fill in the boxes. Take the core courses of the curriculum. You actually have to please Krishna. You have to please the pure devotee and get their blessing. So in that sense, it's causeless. We can't make it happen. And another I was explaining how there are two ideas with causeless. The Prabhupada would translate this, ahoituki apratihata. The ahoituki part, he would generally say, unmotivated. So there are basically two ideas here, causeless and unmotivated. That means there's no cause in the sense that I want something. I'm performing bhakti. The cause of my performing the bhakti is that I want to get something from Krishna. In a sense, we want, what do we want? We want to please Krishna. Of course, we're still in conditioned consciousness, so we have all different kinds of motivations. But ideally, we serve Krishna because he's Krishna, like the residents of Vrindavan. Why? There's no why they serve Krishna. They just love Krishna, that's all. We serve Krishna because that's our constitutional nature. And we've realized that, and we just want to awaken that. That's the is. In philosophy, they sometimes talk about what is the is. If you figure out what is, then you can figure out the ought. Actually, there's some debate about whether you can figure out the is from the ought, the ought from the is. But the idea ought means like ought or should. We tend to say should. We should do this. Well, why should I do this? Well, because the reality is this. The reality is that we're eternal servants of Krishna, therefore we ought to serve Krishna. It's imperative that we serve Krishna because that's our constitutional position. So of course, that's part of the knowledge of Krishna consciousness. We understand these things in theory. But as we advance in Krishna consciousness, it becomes more and more about serving Krishna. I just wrote an editorial at the end. I made the point that our goal is not to enjoy with Krishna. Our goal is to serve Krishna. That should be our aspiration. Krishna, I just want to serve you. That's also our example, the gopis, Ramyaka, Chirupasana, Brajavadu. The gopis are the ideal example of how to please Krishna. So everything they did was only for pleasing Krishna. To me, I find it interesting because it seems like when you read the gopis and their relationship with Krishna, their longing for Krishna, you think they want something. They want something, so they want to go to Krishna because Krishna will fulfill that longing, you can say, in them. So part of the problem is, you know, the language we communicate in, it's not perfect for us to understand certain concepts. But in different places it's stated that, no, everything the gopis did was, why did they dress? Because Krishna will be pleased if he sees me dressed beautifully. It will make him happy. That's all. I only want to see Krishna happy. That's all. Of course, this is epitomized in Srimati Radharani's prayers at the end of the Antyalila Chaitanya Charitamrita, where she says, even if my misery makes Krishna happy, then that's great happiness for me. This is paradoxical, of course, but there are many paradoxical statements in the Parokshavad, it's called. There are many paradoxical statements which sometimes you try to say one thing, but you have to say it sort of in a different way, kind of a come around the backside, make it easier to understand. Just like Rupa Goswami says, if you want to keep your family love, don't look at Krishna on the bank of the Yamuna in the moonlight holding the flute to his lips. If you don't want to lose your family affection, don't look at him. So, actually, it's a gopi who's saying that. Rupa Goswami is quoting her in his meditation. He's seeing this. So that's the point. Really, what we're doing, we're just trying to purify our hearts. We don't want to impose on Krishna. We don't want to sully the spiritual world with our presence there. We want to become fitting associates of Krishna. Like in the cleansing of Gudindicha temple. The Gudindicha temple is a metaphor for purifying our hearts so Krishna will come and sit there. Prabhupada has a wonderful purport there in that section. We want Krishna to come and sit in our hearts and then we'll have a grand festival. So that's what bhakti is about, preparing our hearts as a place for Krishna. So getting back to the main point of the verse, so what is it about? It's about hearing Krishna, remembering Krishna, cutting through karma, cutting through the knot of karma, which is just a side benefit. In other words, that liberation, that's just going to happen. Because we, in a sense, you say, well, we have to be liberated because that's where you serve Krishna. You serve Krishna in transcendence because that's where he lives. If you want to be with Krishna, you have to enter into transcendence. You have to qualify yourself to be there. But when you serve Krishna, then automatically you're elevated to that platform. So we don't think, ideally at least, of course we do in our early stages, we think, I just want the suffering to stop. And we get sick and we just say, maybe I should just die. This suffering, I can't handle it. Krishna, please save me from this suffering. So that's where we're, obviously, we're still connected to this body. We're still bound to it. But in our hearts, ultimately, and we know philosophically, it's not about that kind of liberation. That's not why we're serving Krishna. It's not why we're chanting Hare Krishna, just to end the suffering. We're doing it because we want to please Krishna. Because Krishna wants us back. You know, in Brihad Bhagavatamrita, this wonderful scene, I read it, I'm going a little over here, but I read it in class one time when in Brihad Bhagavatamrita, when Gopakumar goes back to Godhead and he sees Krishna. It's the end of the day and Krishna's coming back from the forest with his friends. And when Krishna sees Gopakumar, he gets so excited, he hugs him and he faints. He starts crying and he faints because he's so happy to see his devotee. Oh, I missed you. You've been gone so long. So the devotee thinks, I want to make Krishna happy. Actually, it's a wonderful scene because everybody says, who is this person? What has he done to Krishna? I think maybe he's one of Kamsa's spies. So it's a beautiful scene. And Balaram comes and he has Krishna lift up. I mean, he has Gopakumar lift up Krishna and caress him and soothe him. And then Krishna's embarrassed because he lost it in public. He did just sort of, you know. He let his emotions all come out. Yeah, it was a wonderful scene there. But the point I was making is that Krishna was so happy. That's the point that Sanatana Goswami is making, that Krishna is waiting for us. He's waiting for us. So that should be our motivation. Oh, Krishna is waiting for me. Let me get back there. Let me try to get back there as soon as I can. All right, I'll read the verse again. Yadanu dhyasina yukta karma granti nibandhanam chindanti kovidastasya ko na kuryat katarathim. With sword in hand, intelligent men cut through the binding knot of reactionary work, karma, by remembering the personality of Godhead. Therefore, who will not pay attention to his message? Ko na kuryat katarathim. Rati, you know the word rati. Here it's translated as attention, but we know it also means attraction. All right, any questions, comments, discussion? Sukadev Prabhu?
Two things I was thinking about. One, just reflecting on karma. And, you know, different times Prabhupada said, you know, all karma is bad karma. But in another sense, all karma is good karma, especially for devotees, because we've seen and read about so many instances where the bad karma was something good for a devotee. Mm. It's like Narada Muni, you know, it's, it sounds pathetic, you know, he just has his mom gets bit by a snake, but all of it catapults him, or even Dhruva. Such a sad situation, but that situation, you know, led to him seeing Krishna personally.
Hmm.
So Prabhupada says that actually, when you're a devotee, it's not really karma anymore. That, you know, Krishna's personally arranging situations so that we can come closer to him. So, I mean, he says both things, but I think that's really significant. Even Vritasura, you look at Vritasura, you know, and everything that happened. Prabhupada says that Parvati, because Krishna instigated in her heart to curse him. And then it turns out that he arranged the whole thing because he wanted Vritasura to come back home, back to Godhead. So.
Yeah, at least we're trained to think that way, that it's all good for me. And they also did that, that other side is true. We devotees sometimes use the phrase Krishna karma because we don't want to say that we're under karma. We're under Krishna, which Prabhupada says also. He says, as soon as one turns to Krishna sincerely, then Krishna says, now this person's under my maya, he's not yours anymore, he's mine now. So then Krishna decides what we get. So he can adjust as he wants. There's a discussion of this in commentaries in Bhaktivedanta Sindhu early. What is, does a devotee still have karma, or is it, what is it exactly? Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says actually there's no karma, it's just an illusion of karma, basically. Krishna's in charge. So we think, well, Krishna wants, he's our ever well wisher, so he's trying to arrange things for our benefit. It's up to us to see it in that way. Sometimes it's difficult, of course. Devotees say, I can't see why would Krishna do this to me or even somebody else. But that's, you know, part of our growth in Krishna consciousness is to take these things and to see them. We're being trained on how to see them, and we have so many examples in our tradition how devotees dealt with setbacks and so on. So it's important. It's, you know, ultimately it's about the change of heart. So it's how we see things and put it into practice. Yes.
You were explaining that, so it's not part of bhakti to enjoy, to strive for enjoyment on any level. So, but the eternal quality of the soul is to be blissful, full of knowledge. So the bliss that the soul is experiencing is different from the from any kind of enjoyment. I mean, when you're blissful, you're enjoying something, right?
Yeah. I mean, I was really, you know, sometimes you can make emphasize one point at the kind of at the expense of another. So I was making this point, it's important to think of ourselves as servants. But this is something that I think about. Even sometimes when I'm giving class, I'm thinking of the other side in the back of my mind. You know? So in many places in our literature, we're told to enjoy, basically. Pibata Bhagavatam Rasamalayam Uhurahora Sikabhuvi Bhagavatam. Right in the beginning, Vyasadeva says, drink the nectar of this Srimad Bhagavatam. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says, we're being told to just keep drinking it. It's so much nectar, you're going to pass out, but then you're going to come to consciousness again, and you're going to keep drinking again because it's so much nectar. So there's this word aswadana, or swadu, also in the, right in the beginning. It's swadu, swadu, pade, pade. The sages of Naimisharanya say that those who have captured the lotus feet of Krishna in their heart, hearing about him, it's nectar at every step. So we hear about this over. There are so many places. Every morning we sing in the Guru Vashtakam, Chiradika Madhava Yorapada Madhurya Lila Guna Rupanamna Pratikshana Swadana Lolupasya. What does that mean? Pratikshana means moment after moment. Aswadana, tasting, relishing. Lolupasya, Lolupasya means lowlium. The spiritual master has lowlium, has greed, has longing to taste the nectar of Radha Madhava's guna rupa, lila, pastimes, form, qualities, and pastimes. So this is, it's the idea, I think, is that it's, well, you can't, like you're saying, well, it's who we are. Especially when the advanced devotee is invested with the Srup Shakti, which is really the platform of bhakti. As I was saying, you have to get it from Krishna. Krishna gives that. Then you experience a Ladini Shakti. Then, well, what can you do? You have to enjoy. And it's just natural. We're enjoying creatures or souls by constitution. So it's naturally there. And again, we're encouraged. Just like Prabhupada, so many times, you look up the phrase in the Veda base, back to Godhead, how many times Prabhupada said, and you will go back home, back to Godhead. So many times he said. But other times he said, the devotee doesn't care if he goes back to Godhead. He just wants to serve Krishna everywhere. So which one is right? There are places where he says, no, everyone should want to go back to Godhead. In another place he'll say, no, we don't want to go back to Godhead. We just want to stay here in this material world and preach in Krishna's behalf. So, you know, Krishna consciousness is very broad, and sometimes we have these competing ideas, you might say. And I think also, I've made this point before, that Prabhupada is a Mahabhagavat, and he can accommodate these kinds of seeming contradictions. And according to his bhava, he's going to speak in certain ways. Sometimes, Prabhupada often uses superlative terms, like always, everyone, and these kinds of things. And you might think, well, does it really mean everyone? Or immediately, probably used immediately a lot. And you look and you say, you know, as soon as one chants Hare Krishna, one immediately feels ecstasy from the spiritual platform. And you think, well, really? Maybe the soul is, but I'm not experiencing it. But it's Prabhupada's ecstasy. Even he said, my purports are my devotional ecstasy. So sometimes you can, you know, Prabhupada is in a particular mood and he's making a particular point. You know, there's a principle in hearing Shastra that one shouldn't bring in contradictory points. There should be submissive oral reception. And, we sometimes do that. There was one devotee in our temple years ago, he would always say, well, what about, you know, you made this point, but what about this? So the idea, but sometimes Prabhupada, when someone was asking this question, he would say, no, stick to the point. You get this point? Do you understand what I'm saying here? Don't go on to something else. Get this point. So, you know, sometimes we're making one point and maybe sort of downplaying another one, but they're all important points. Another time we can focus. I sometimes think about this, for example, you have a verse that's about grihastha life. So you can give two kinds of classes about grihastha life, certainly. And many things, especially when you talk about social things. You can give a really hard line, or you can give a more lenient, you know, way of looking at it. There are different perspectives. There are spectrums also in different issues, philosophical issues even, and social issues as they relate to Krishna consciousness. So it's very broad. There's so many ways to dive in. Getting back to this verse, there's so many things to meditate on. Prabhupada told, I think it was Brahmananda, an early letter, he said, your life should never be without ISKCON thought, he said. So ISKCON was brand new, and he wanted the devotees to dedicate themselves to the mission. So that was their dhyan at that time. Think always about how to spread this mission. Anyway, a little elaboration there. All right, I guess it's time to stop. 9 o'clock. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.